United States v. Urrea. Captain Hamdoun, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant?
I am, Your Honor.
And Major Lamb, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Very well then, please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court. Chief Judge, appellant respectfully requests to reserve 3 minutes of time for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you, Chief Judge. Appellant's exercise of a fundamental right to choice of counsel was repeatedly denigrated by a member's misunderstandings in voir dire. The member, Sergeant Byers, drew the trial court's attention to the impermissible idea that appellant's act in hiring a civilian defense counsel was probative of guilt. Upon questioning by the defense, Sergeant Byers made clear that what he was acknowledging was in fact his own belief and bias, and instead of according careful treatment to a bias that struck at the core of appellant's defense, the military judge denied appellant's actual and implied bias challenges without issuing a single curative instruction or educating the member of appellant's fundamental constitutional rights.
Counsel, how does a military judge or a CCA or this court know when or if a prospective panel member has been rehabilitated or not? So let me pose a hypothetical to you. Prospective panel member comes in and his initial position based on questioning is that the accused has the burden of demonstrating that he is not guilty. The prospective panel member is informed that that is incorrect. He acknowledges that. He says that he will follow the instructions of the military judge. In your view, is there still a risk that a member of the public would view it as being unfair to have their prospective panel member sit?
Yes, Your Honor, and this is geared towards implied bias, perhaps.
Yes, so in the implied bias context.
Yes, Your Honor, even with instructions and attempted rehabilitation, a lengthy colloquy, a member of the public, especially considering this case where there are constitutional rights, basic ones that number more than two, there's a sense from the public that the member could not have been, despite the efforts, could not have been rehabilitated.
So what authority do you cite for that, that someone cannot be rehabilitated in the implied bias context?
The authority, the case, I believe, Rogers, stands for even with instructions and attempts to rehabilitate, a member of the public, because it's an objective test and doesn't incorporate the military judge's findings as to demeanor, there may still be a member of the public concerned with the fairness of the trial.
But wasn't Rogers and similar cases, weren't they really based on the specific facts of the case rather than an absolute rule that someone cannot be rehabilitated once they, out of the box, state something that is, if it had not been corrected, would have been disqualifying?
Yes, Your Honor. In each case, the facts matter for actual and implied bias.
So just to be clear then, you're not arguing for an absolutist rule?
No, sir. No, Your Honor.
So then there are cases you are stating where a person can be rehabilitated, a prospective panel member can be rehabilitated in an implied bias context.
Yes, Your Honor. We don't expect a member to come in to court martials understanding the law and the nuances, and of course that there's a chance a member can be rehabilitated, especially if it concerns matters that a service member wouldn't be familiar with unless instructed by the military judge.
So then why in this particular case was this prospective panel member not in fact rehabilitated?
Your Honor, there's no attempt from the military judge to explain civilian counsel, what the role of civilian counsel is. This court can distinguish what happened here with Napolitano. And in that case, the military judge interrupted the colloquy between counsel and the member to explain the role of a civilian defense counsel. They're not here as a gun for hire. In this case, the military judge should have explained to the member that you may take no negative inference. You may not penalize the appellant here for hiring a civilian defense counsel and believe this is a retrial. There had to be more as far as instructions on the law and instructions on where we are, because the member said appellant's act of hiring a civilian defense counsel, he's only seen for retrials. Military judge should have stepped in. No, this is not a retrial. You are to presume that appellant is innocent until the close of evidence when you can deliberate.
May I just ask you about those curative instructions? In Napolitano, the judge did it sua sponte. Here, the judge didn't do it sua sponte. How is this supposed to work? I mean, defense counsel didn't ask for it. Trial counsel didn't ask for it. Is there any consequence if nobody asks for it? And is it trial counsel's responsibility to ask for a curative instruction if they oppose the motion to dismiss the juror, dismiss the member?
Your Honor, ultimately, it touches on multiple areas of the law, but the military judge is the gatekeeper, and he does have a sua sponte duty.
I don't doubt that the military judge has a sua sponte, and if he had given curative instructions, we wouldn't be here. But nobody asked him to give the curative instruction, and he didn't do it. And I'm just saying, is there any forfeiture or waiver because counsel on both sides sat on their hands?
So counsel for defense, Your Honor, they have an ethical obligation for their client. And this court has given notice to military judge that they must fill the gaps left by counsel for biased challenges. And it's an abuse of discretion, like it was in Nash, where the military judge in Camisio, where the military judge does not test the bias when he is obligated to from this court's precedent.
Counsel, this is – oh, are you set? Thank you. This is actually a follow-on to the Chief's question, and I apologize because I'm probably getting ahead of you in argument. But one of the – this goes to the implied bias and specifically the liberal grant mandate, and that this court has wrestled with essentially who gets to decide, is it a close call? And it ties into the question that Chief raised with regards to the potential for rehabilitation. We have the presumption that, you know, the military judge observes the potential panel member. They can assess their demeanor, credibility, and the like. And so what, if any, deference should we give to the military judge if they decide this isn't a close call?
Yes, Your Honor. I think this court's decision in Kiego analyzed the close call for implied bias with the same standard of review as it considered the implied bias. So this court in Kiego found closer to de novo, this is a close call. But if it was an actual bias challenge, then you would give more deference to the military judge because there is the question of sincerity and demeanor that the military judge is able to consider. But it's the military judge's call for whether the case is close, and then this court uses, to echo the words, whether it convincingly demonstrates a departure, whether the member does demonstrate that departure, or whether it's, in fact, still a close call. The member in group voir dire acknowledged that he had heard that the act of hiring a civilian defense counsel must mean a soldier is guilty. When called for individual voir dire, the member was asked an open-ended question. What is your opinion of civilian defense counsel? The member responded, to me, hiring an outside civilian lawyer means you don't trust your defense very much. Another open-ended question from defense counsel related to whether the member thinks it's unusual to hire civilian defense counsel. The member responded, in my experience, I have only ever seen people hire civilian defense counsel after they have already been through the trial, they didn't get the outcome they were looking for, so they went to a retrial with a civilian lawyer. At that time, the military judge had to correct the member's misunderstandings. to instruct the member that appellant's act in hiring a civilian defense counsel was not in any way probative of guilt, and that the most innocent of accused do well by retaining counsel, that appellant had a constitutional statutory right to choice of counsel, and appellant's act of hiring a civilian defense counsel implicates a fundamental due process right to present a defense, as it is through appellant's attorney that the government's evidence is tested at trial. But the military judge made matters worse and amplified the issues of actual and implied bias. The only point in the record, the two questions the military judge asks, the member comes back and clarifies his belief that appellant doesn't trust his defense not only includes his case or his attorneys, it means all of it, which is a point of ambiguity that the military judge was obligated to resolve.
Counsel, I find a lot of parallels between this case and our previous decision in Kigo. And in Kigo, there were both actual and implied bias challenges, and we upheld the actual bias challenges. You've argued that we should reverse the CCA's decisions upholding the military judge's decisions with respect to actual bias. So what differentiates this case from Kigo in your mind with respect to the actual bias? What happened differently in this case in Kigo in terms of the actual bias analysis?
Your Honor, in this case, the military judge made no findings of fact as to the member's demeanor, his sincerity, leaving this court with a cold appellate record. And to go more into the abuse of discretion standard employed by this court for actual bias, he failed to consider the totality of circumstances, in that you could see in his two-sentence ruling that he really weighs what the member is saying as far as perception. And in Comicio, this court found that the totality of circumstances needs to be considered, and the military judge failing to consider an important fact was an abuse of discretion. Same here. But in Kiego, the military judge made those findings of fact, did articulate the disclaimers and the claims of impartiality. But here, it's not supported by any findings of fact from the judge that, you know, I find this member to be credible. I find him to be sincere. So that's a difference marker. And similar, it's not Kiego, but it's Napolitano. That's a similar case in that there's a civilian defense counsel, and there's confusion about the role of civilian defense counsel. In that case, this court analyzed how often the military judge stepped in and explained, and there was an evolution of thinking, right, to find no actual bias. And here we have the opposite. If this court does not find actual bias, we would ask that it still find implied bias, and that the risk is too high. The public will perceive that appellant was tried by something less than fair and impartial members, asking this court to apply standard review closer to de novo review. And at a very minimum, there should have been the liberal grant mandate considered by the military judge with careful, serious treatment, with more of an analysis on the record. So at the very minimum, we ask this court to uphold the liberal grant mandate, the implied bias doctrine, if it does not find actual bias in this case. Pending any further questions.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Captain.
Thank you.
Major Lamb.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. My name is Major Joseph Lamb, and I, along with my co-counsel, Colonel Richard Guarini, represent the United States. The military judge here acted well within his discretion by allowing Sergeant First Class B to serve on the panel because Sergeant B had established his impartiality during voir dire, and no reasonable member of the public would find that appellant received anything less than a court of fair and impartial members. First, when we take a look at Sergeant B's statements themselves, we find that he shows impartiality. He indicates no fewer than four times that he will not hold appellant's decision to hire a civilian defense counsel against either appellant himself or defense counsel. He then goes on to state under oath that he does not believe hiring civilian defense counsel signifies either an admission of guilt or even a thought of guilt. And then in his last words to the court, he makes clear that he will not at all hold appellant's hiring decision against him and that he will consider just the facts during his deliberation. Second, the military judge...
Can I stop you there for a moment, please? So how does this fit within Kegel, where we express concerns about a prospective panel member who comes in and says X, and then he or she is prodded in such a way that they say Y? But it's based on leading questions, and there's the concern that they're simply mimicking back, parroting what it is apparent is the correct response. In an implied bias context, how would a member of the public view that in terms of feeling confident that this prospective panel member truly feels that way as compared to giving the right answer on a test?
To answer your question, Your Honor, if indeed the trial counsel was asking leading questions and causing the member to parrot back answers, that would give a reasonable member of the public less confidence in the fairness of the proceedings. But to be clear, Your Honor, that's not what happened here. In JA 079 to 080, we see that the trial counsel asks a question about what the appellant, what Sergeant B thinks of civilian defense counsel. And Sergeant B answers, I don't think it's an admission of guilt or a thought of guilt. Those words, admission of guilt, thought of guilt, those came out of Sergeant B's mouth himself. They came from his mind. The trial counsel did not say, you don't think it's an admission of guilt, do you? Or you don't think it's a thought of guilt, do you? And when Sergeant B talks about not at all holding the decision against the appellant and that he would consider just the facts, not at all, period, that's a phrase that came from Sergeant B. Just the facts, period, that's a phrase that also came from Sergeant B's mouth. Those weren't prompted by the trial counsel. In fact, if you look at the record here, Your Honor, there's no mention of this phrase until Sergeant B actually opens his mouth. Those are his own words, that's his own wording, and those are his own thoughts, Your Honor. And a reasonable member of the public would have confidence that Sergeant B was actually indeed not at all going to hold appellant's hiring decision
against
him. But
it's not as clean as that, right? It's not as clean as you made it out to be, because he follows that statement that you just recited with, it is unusual to me, right? What does that mean? Like, why should it be unusual to hire a civilian defense counsel?
Your Honor, based on the context, unusual when Sergeant B uses it, he's not using it in a way to cast any type of moral judgment or disapproval about Specius Urieta's hiring decision. We see that unusual, given the context, literally just means it's outside of his common range of experiences. This is not usual to him. He's probably used to seeing soldiers represented by trial defense counsel who are from the military. And that's further bolstered by the fact that he talks about his experience and what he's aware of in JA 077. He says, in my experience, I've only seen civilian defense counsel hired in very limited circumstances. He doesn't draw any type of negative inference from that. He doesn't say, and therefore, I think they're guilty.
Those aren't good circumstances. The limited circumstances in which he's seen it aren't good circumstances. He's not saying, I've only seen it when there are really rich service members who can afford it or something else. It's when they've lost, right? And they're up for retrial.
Your Honor, we disagree. The record is not describing that they were found guilty or that they lost. They're saying that what Sergeant B is saying that is that in certain circumstances, civilian counsel was hired during retrial. And retrial can arise from, for example, mistrial or when there's a certain number of panel members that falls below the requirement in the middle of trial.
We don't get many retrials after acquittals.
Sorry, Your Honor.
I said we don't get many retrials after acquittals.
No, that's impossible,
Your Honor. And furthermore, the quote here is it's after their lawyers have let them down. Presumably, an accused does not feel as if his or her lawyer has let them down if they were acquitted.
No, Your Honor, but again, what we're describing here, what we see from Sergeant B, is he's recounting his own experience. He's not drawing any type of negative inference. Perhaps it was from a negative situation, but Sergeant B doesn't go on to take the extra step of saying, that's why I think he's guilty, or that's why I've made this inference that Specialist Urieta has already shown some sign of guilt. From the beginning of voir dire to the end, he's been stating that he's not going to hold this decision against either appellant himself or the defense counsel. He makes clear he doesn't think of this as an admission of guilt. At most, he thinks it's unusual. And that word unusual.
I mean, is that really consistent with what he said to the military judge? Because the military asked him, you said that you believe that hiring a civilian counsel means that you don't trust your defense very much. And he answers, I did. And then the military judge says, when you say your defense, do you mean your defense counsel, as in the attorneys, or do you mean the defense, as in the case that you're going to present? And he says, all of it. Right? That's how can we interpret that as any other way as that the that he thinks that if a service member goes out and hires a civilian defense counsel, that that person has serious doubts about their ability to get a fair trial, at least in the system, or at least like that they may have serious ability about their ability to be acquitted, right? It's an indicator. He's taking it. It seems like he's taking it, or there's a strong possibility that he's taking it as an inference on his presumption of innocence.
No, Your Honor. According to appellant's own reply brief on page 4, he refers to these statements as ambiguous, Your Honor. And assuming for the sake of argument that these statements were indeed ambiguous, we should interpret them based on the clear statements that Sergeant B has made at the beginning and end of his voir dire. Clear statements such as the fact that he doesn't believe hiring defense counsel, civilian defense counsel, is an admission of guilt, or that he's going to consider just the facts. We use the clear statements to help shape and interpret these ambiguous statements, and they set the left and right limits of what these statements here about your defense could possibly mean. And
when I don't want us to get too far from that, because that is the issue that I have. We're, again, setting aside actual bias, but the implied bias, and the fact that at best these are ambiguous statements. At worst, they're contradictory, and that since we're reviewing whether the military judge abused his discretion in this area, what was the role or responsibility of the military judge with regards to resolving this ambiguity?
Your Honor, the military judge did resolve the ambiguity here through his questioning on page JA-079. He took on that responsibility to clarify what exactly your defense meant. And he wanted to clarify, does your defense mean your defense counsel, that is, your original defense counsel previously, or does it mean the case that you're going to present, that is, the case that the original defense counsel was preparing and planning to present on your behalf at court-martial?
Is it the government's position? Did the military judge make an erroneous finding of fact?
No, Your Honor, he did not.
How so?
Your Honor, there was nothing in the military judge's ruling that was erroneous. And I think what will add clarity to the situation is that appellant conflates two perceptions that were discussed during voir dire. There is a perception that is an outside perception, and it's discussed in JA 79 to 80. There's an outside perception that if you hire a civilian counsel, you don't trust the military justice system as a whole. You don't trust the military system as a whole.
Well, that's what he eventually said to the trial counsel. But earlier on, in response to the questions from the ADC, he personalized it to me hiring an outside counsel in my experience. So the point is, when you juxtaposition his statements, at best, like I said, they're ambiguous. I can say that word. Como se dice? But, you know, at worst, you know, they're contradictory. And so my question is, as appellant has argued, What was the responsibility as the military judge, as the gatekeeper, as it were, to resolve that ambiguity? The military judge, in my view, his question does not resolve the ambiguity between the perception that you say is an outside one versus the perception that you had earlier said is your personal perception. And in fact, as I recall his ruling, the one of his reasons for denying the motion was that he said that the perception was just an outside one.
Your Honor, to answer your question, the military judge's role is to allow defense counsel ample opportunity to make the record clear and about what exactly Sergeant B meant or what a panel member states. Ultimately, though, the burden of persuasion rests on the movant, the person who's actually making the challenge. And so the defense counsel has the requirement to meet that burden of persuasion. We see that, for example, in United States versus Bagstad, a case in which the defense counsel had just brought out the fact that one of the members was raiding another member and left it at that and didn't go any further. And the court said, that's on defense counsel. He didn't ask any further questions to flesh out any closeness of the relationship, for example. In United States versus Richardson, a case in which appellant cites, the military judge was faulted because it's not that he didn't ask a certain question or he didn't flesh out something himself. He prevented the military defense counsel from asking questions and fleshing out the relationships between the trial counsel and the panel member, Major Callahan. And because of that, that's why the military judge had committed error. I want to clarify again, Your Honor, that there is a perception that Sergeant B does hold it. So there's the outside perception that he doesn't trust the military justice system as a whole. That's very clear in JA 79 to 80. But there's also a perception that he does indeed hold. Granted, he does believe that if you hire civilian defense counsel, you don't trust your defense counsel, that is the original defense counsel, or the case that the original defense counsel is going to present. And granted, that's not a totally accurate view of the way things work. Civilian defense counsel can come onto the scene, for example, by many reasons. It doesn't have anything that might not have anything to do with how much you trust your original defense counsel. But that has no bearing on his ability to impartially and fairly serve as a fact finder in this case. If he has the misbelief, perhaps he says, I've watched Law and Order, I know that when TDS is representing a service member, that must mean the service member is indigent. That might be a false belief. He doesn't realize that every service member is entitled to a trial defense service lawyer. But that doesn't mean he is unable or unwilling to serve as a fact finder, determine a very specific question of guilt or not guilt. And we see that in cases like United States versus Roll, in which a panel member had a misconception about the law. He said that he would not be able to adjudge no punishment in the case. And the court found that there was no implied bias in their case because there was no real sentencing issue. The court noted that the defense counsel themselves didn't ask for no punishment. The defense counsel asked for a minimum amount of punishment. So that was a misconception of the law that had no material bearing, and thus was not a proper implied bias challenge. We also see that in, for example, United States versus Schlamer, a case in which a panel member said that rape should lead to castration, theft should lead to the loss of a hand. And the court noted
counsel, we're not talking about a simple misunderstanding of the law here. We're talking about a misunderstanding about some sort of fundamental constitutional rights, whether you put it as the presumption of innocence or you put it as the right to counsel choice. Either way, these are sort of core principles that the panel member appears to have misunderstood, right? And that's sort of exactly the same situation we have in Kigo. And so I'm going to ask you a similar question that I asked appellant's counsel, which is how, at least in the implied bias context, how is this case significantly different than Kigo that would lead the court to come to a different conclusion?
Your Honor, this case is significantly different from Kigo because in Kigo we had Lieutenant Commander Charlie who stated that he could be impartial and unbiased. He gave assurances of impartiality, but those were quickly followed up with statements that tempered and diluted those previous assurances. He stated that he would still like to hear the accused side of the story, that it would still come to mind when he's in deliberation. That tempers any assurance of impartiality that he just gave. Lieutenant Commander Mike stated that you need to give clear and convincing evidence of consent, that we should err on the side of believing the victim, and those statements were never corrected by the military judge. The military judge didn't even ask any questions, and the government didn't even object to the challenge there. In this case, we have a military judge who did ask questions, and we had a military judge who was engaged in the process.
I mean, I agree that the military judge asked questions, but the questions didn't really help the government's case here at all, did they? I mean, if anything, they made it worse. They took an ambiguous statement about we're not sure what he meant when he said, when he was referring to his defense, and then the military judge made it crystal clear that he meant every aspect of the defense. So you're right that the military judge here did intervene, which the military judge didn't do in Kigo, but not in any helpful way.
No, Your Honor, the military judge did help in this case. If the military judge had not asked the clarifying question, all we would be left with is Sergeant B's statement that if you hire a civilian defense counsel, you don't believe in your defense. And that's a broad enough statement that we could reasonably infer that he means that if you hire a civilian defense counsel, you don't believe you have a defense or any defense. But despite, contrary to what appellant asserts, appellant continually asserts that Sergeant B is stating or implying that when you hire civilian defense counsel, you've already lost your case, you don't have a defense or any defense. But when we look at the actual text of what the trial transcript shows, Sergeant B doesn't state that at all. In fact, he states quite the opposite. Again, he's stating hiring civilian defense counsel is not an admission of guilt. It's not even a thought of guilt. I'm not at all going to hold it against the appellant for hiring civilian defense counsel. It's not even going to come to mind. I'm going to consider just the facts. He also shows earlier that he's able and willing to follow the court's instructions when he states that he'll follow the legal definition of consent on JA-79. And he shows an actual willingness to follow the military judge's instructions. And also under United States versus Hassan, members are presumed to understand and follow the judge's instructions. And of course, one of those instructions was the order that you should consider only legal and competent evidence when making a finding of guilt. And of course, in this case, hiring civilian defense counsel is not legal and competent evidence.
Counsel, on that point about following the instructions, appellant emphasizes that the military judge did not make two key curative instructions, one that civilian counsel could be chosen and it shouldn't be held against the person, and two, that there was you're not to believe that he had been previously convicted. Was it abuse of discretion not to give those curative instructions? Was it, if the curative instructions were to be given, did one side or the other have an obligation to ask for them? I mean, obviously, this would be a very different case if we had an instruction like in Napolitano, but we didn't have those curative instructions. We had the general instruction, which you just mentioned. But what about the specific ones that appellant counsel suggests it was abuse of discretion not to give?
No, Your Honor, it would not be an abuse of discretion. I believe, if I recall correctly, Your Honor stated the two things appellant said should be the curative instructions is that you don't draw any negative inferences of guilt because of the hiring of civilian defense counsel. Sergeant B already stated, I don't think it's an admission of guilt. I don't think it's even a thought of guilt. He's already stating the proper beliefs about civilian defense counsel. There's no need to cure him. I suppose you could do another curative instruction, but it wasn't an abuse of discretion to not do it. And he's also stating he's not at all going to hold it against Specialist Urieta. He's going to consider just the facts. So it was with his last points that he drove home to the court, Your Honor. And he already has the right beliefs, so he doesn't need a curative instruction. Pending the court's questions, we respectfully ask that the court affirm the findings and sentence.
I see no further questions. Thank you, Major Lamb. Captain Hamdoum.
The one point I'd like to make, Chief Judge, is the government's harping on the statements It's not an admission of guilt or a thought of guilt. And as Judge Hardy immediately followed up with, there was still a dilution of that claim of impartiality, in that the member said, it is still unusual to me. And unusual was first appeared in the record related to this challenge when defense counsel asked, do you think it's unusual when there's a civilian defense counsel? And that's when the member went through his experience of retrials and his ever only seeing people hiring a civilian defense counsel after getting a negative outcome. Pending any further questions.
Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand adjourned until further order of the court.
All right. The court is adjourned until further order of the court.